At a million other choices, we discuss some dark and troubling topics. If dark and troubling is not your thing, mine might not be the right podcast for you. If you like your dark topics discussed without pesky ads and are looking for some additional content from me, you can sign up for the exclusive feed. The link should be in the show notes, and if not, you can find me on redcircle.com. I research each case myself, and I do my best to use a wide variety of sources, preferably directly from court documents when they're available, to ensure that the information is as accurate as possible. But I cannot verify the truth of all reporting that is publicly available. So this episode has been produced for information and entertainment purposes only and should be taken as such. And with all my legal and publicity stuff out of the way, let's listen to what words I will inadvertently mispronounce today.
You obviously have a very high tolerance for murder.
May God bless your drunk, broken soul.
The conduct was horrendous, inhumane, and nothing short of evil.
But was she dead on the day I arrived?
She was dead when you killed her.
I am tackling a very ugly one today, the crimes of Clifford Olson, who is often referred to as the Beast of British Columbia, but I think he gave himself that name originally, so let's not call him that. But he is a mean one, Mr. Grinch. He is awful, he's terrible, and he's disgusting. I think a lot of you probably know his name, but I don't know if many of you know the cases and who he was and what he really did and a lot of the controversy that surrounded him. So let's dive into this most treacherous of demons. Oh, and I got a lot of background information today from a Jan Kerr from Crime Library. I have no idea where or if her writings were ever published anywhere else. It appears that a lot of her sources for her research was a few books that were written on the cases, so I can't really verify the validity of her research. So we're just going to kind of go through the gist of the story today, and hopefully the main points of the story are not missed. And if you're wondering why I don't personally put sources in my show notes, there's a couple of reasons. One is because the majority of my cases I cover are Canadian, so like CBC, Global, the National Post, all of them, they all release the same information, which usually comes directly from court. Now, media outlets here tend to share their information a little bit more here. But if somebody did take the time to do like a detailed piece on case or write a detailed article or get interviews with people, something like that, then I cite them within the episode. Then of course, stats and all that stuff, I'll always try and tell you where I got that information from. But probably the biggest reason I don't cite sources is because I don't speak in any way, shape, or form the way a journalist would or the way they would write. So absolutely everything that you hear from me is in my own words. It's paraphrased. Like I'm just basically sitting here telling you what I heard and what I learned about the case and telling it to you over your coffee or whatever you're doing right now. Anyways, speaking of direct quotes, quote, "I don't have the words to describe the enormity of your crimes and the heartbreak and anguish you have caused so many people," end quote. So these were the words of Justice Harry McKay as he sentenced Clifford Olson to 11 life sentences back in 1982. Now, what could one person have done to leave a judge, like a criminal judge, without any words? Well, Clifford Olson goes down in our Canadian history, like our criminal history, as being probably worse than Robert Picton and Paul Bernardo combined. So we have to get ready for this one and buckle up because it's going to be a bit of a long one. So we're going to start on Monday, November 17th, 1980. Now, there's going to be a lot of dates thrown at you, but we'll just try to keep it together. So that Monday, 12-year-old Christine Weller, she had school. She was living with her parents at the Bonanza Motel in Surrey, BC, which is just outside of Vancouver. She was the super outdoorsy type of kid, and she'd made plans after school that day to go to the Surrey Place Mall. I'm 12 years old, going to the mall, big thing to do in the 80s. And the Surrey Place Mall had just opened up a new section. So her and her friend were going to go check it out, just window shopping. And they did that. And she wandered the mall doing their thing. And About 5 o'clock, she's thinking she needs to, she's going to be late for dinner. So she borrowed her friend's bike to make the journey home. And like literally this journey home was down a hill, like not very far at all. But she didn't make it. And well, there is some stuff that I think we're all going to get a little bit judgy about, but it doesn't really change the outcome of Christine's story. So her parents weren't actually too worried about her. They figured she was staying with a friend for a couple of days, which was something that I guess that she did rather frequently. Now, to be fair, there were not cell phones then. Nobody had like Find My iPhone back then. And since they were living in a motel, they might not have had like a phone in their unit. But her parents didn't actually report her missing until almost about a week later. And at first, the police, they figured that she had just kind of run away. But when they found her bike, or the bike that she had borrowed, behind an animal hospital, which was a few blocks from her motel room, they started to get a little bit worried that maybe something could have happened to her and that maybe she hadn't run away. And then on Christmas Day, if you can imagine Christmas Day, a man, he's just out walking his dog along like a canal. And this canal sort of goes along behind a dump, but just off of River Road. And he finds Christine's little body with multiple stab wounds in her chest and abdomen, as well as manual strangulation from a belt. Now, I'm not sure if the belt was still on her at the time or if it were the marks left behind, but that showed that she'd been strangled. But there's not a lot to go off of. And the murderer was kind of determined to be stranger on stranger, kind of like random, like stranger to stranger. So family and friends were ruled out, but they really had no suspects. Then on April 16th, 1981, so this is 5 months after Christine was last seen, 13-year-old Colin Dagnall was on Easter break from school. She was having a sleepover at her friend's house and told her grandma that she would be home around 4 o'clock that day. And so getting to her friend's house to home would have meant taking two buses because her friend actually lived in Delta. And she was going to Old Yell Road, which is also in Surrey, which is near Scott Road on the Surrey side of the Patullo Bridge. So Surrey is on Vancouver Island and on the south side of the Fraser River. So like Burnaby and the city of Vancouver are on the other side of the river from Surrey. So directly south of Port Moody or Coquitlam, which probably doesn't help anyone not from Canada, but that's where it is. And in 1980, the population of Surrey was just over $100,000 people. And now it's a little bit closer to about 200,000. And I should mention that Surrey, although the overall crime rate there is about 26% higher than the national average, when it comes to violent crime, it's actually 5% lower than the national average. Anyways, Colleen didn't make it home and was reported missing and was considered also to be a runaway. So she wasn't really looked for, in other words. And 5 months after that, so on September 17th, so almost a year after Christine went missing, her skeletal remains were found in a wooded area east of 144th Street and 26th Avenue. Now, her sister remembers being the one that had to identify her red Adidas t-shirt that she had borrowed from her to wear to her friend's place. Then only 5 days after Colleen disappeared, so this was April 22nd, 1981, 16-year-old Darren Johnsrud vanished. Now, he was originally from Saskatchewan, where he was living with his dad. But as a birthday present, his mom had flown him out to Coquitlam with his 12-year-old brother and 9-year-old sister. He had plans. He was going to finish out the school year back in Saskatchewan, and then he was going to move to Coquitlam full-time to live with his mom. Now, he was also on his spring break or Easter break from school, because it was the same week that Colleen had gone missing. So he was staying at his mom's in her housing complex, and he went to the drugstore to buy a pack of cigarettes. And then he was never seen alive again. His body was found at the bottom of an embankment about 7 miles east of Mission on the north side of the Fraser River on May 2nd. It was beside like a dike or a canal at Deroche. On May 19th, 1981, so this is a little less than a month after that, Sandra Wolfsteiner was hitchhiking to visit her boyfriend. Now, she was from Chilliwack. I'm not sure where she was actually headed to, but her remains weren't found until September, about 50 miles east of Vancouver. And because of the terrain where she was found, there wasn't really enough left of her body to positively identify her. It was just because of animals in the area. Now, we have to come back to Sandra a little bit later, so kind of put a pin in that. So now let's just kind of stop and kind of regroup here. So Christine was the first to go missing, and that was in April of 1980. And then it was April of 1981 when both Colleen and Darren went missing. Then in May, it was Sandra who went missing, but nothing is connected at all at this point to any of them. So by Christmas of 1980, Christine had been found, her body had been found. But there were no suspects in that case at all. And then in April of 1981, Colleen has, she's only gone missing at that point. And so far she's being treated as a runaway. And Darren has disappeared a couple of days after that. Now his body has been found, or was found, and it's definitely a murder, but they wouldn't connect the disappearance of like a 13-year-old girl and a 16-year-old boy. So there really wasn't much of an investigation. Like, there was an investigation going into both of their murders, but not as trying to connect them. Then on June 21st, 1981, 13-year-old Ada Court was babysitting for her little brother's, or for her brother's little ones in Coquitlam. And she took a bus to go and see her boyfriend from their place when they got home. But she never made it to either her boyfriend's or home. Now, this time they weren't actually convinced that she had run away, because she had taken nothing from her locker at school and she'd left all her belongings there. And she was a very regular babysitter for her brother. But again, at this point, the only body that has been found is Christine, and that was found in Surrey. The body of Darren, who disappeared from Coquitlam, but Ada's disappearance is being looked at as a probable murder, just due to the circumstances around her disappearance. Then on July 2nd, 1981, a little 9-year-old boy named Simon Partington went missing in Surrey. So he was the sixth disappearance in less than 2 years. Most of them happened in the spring of 1981. Now, the case of Simon was immediately treated differently because 9-year-olds don't normally run away. And little Simon was on his bike. He was just wearing his jeans and a t-shirt. He was on his way to a friend's house when he vanished. And it was only a few blocks from where Christine had last been seen when she was murdered. But the two murders didn't fit with each other. And the others, again, they're just sort of disappearances at this point. But the media had started to notice that there seemed to be a lot of children going missing from the suburbs all of a sudden. They called them the Lower Mainland Missing Children. So the RCMP starts putting together this little task force. Well, it's kind of like a task force. It was really more just like having a meeting with some law enforcement people. And they're discussing these cases, which they're starting to refer to as these missing Lower Mainland children. And there's this one guy, his last name is Forsyth, but I'm not actually sure of his first name. And he's telling them that these cases could not only be connected, but he's liking this guy named Clifford Olson, at least for Ada's murder. And like, why is that? Well, he says he doesn't know. He just kind of has a feeling. So there's this guy. He's 34 years old. He's married. His wife just had a baby. But he has spent actually most of his adult life in and out of prison, mostly for con artist type of stuff. But while he was in there in Prince Albert, the Prince Albert Penitentiary in Saskatchewan, he's cellmates with this guy named Gary Marquois, who was accused of strangling and raping 9-year-old Gina Dove and then tying her body to a tree. Now, she was found really close to Weaver Lake, which is going to be kind of an important location later. And Clifford was able to get this Gary guy to write out a confession which convicted him. And Clifford also had a tendency to lure people in usually young people with the offer of a job of about $10 an hour cash. And just last week, like the week before, he had been arrested for indecent assault against a 16-year-old girl. And isn't it kind of odd that this guy just gets out of prison and these kids start disappearing and from all kinds of places that this Olsen guy was living and working at the time. Like he was in Surrey when Christine and Darren went missing, and now he's in Coquitlam. And they're like, well, yeah, but like, he's a con artist. Like he's not, we don't even know if these kids have been murdered. We just know that they're missing. And we have some girls, we have some boys, we have some that are younger, some that are older. It just doesn't fit any kind of pattern. But this guy, this Forsyth guy, is like, I don't know. I just have a feeling about it. So they decide, well, we'll put him on the list of possibles, but we just really don't think so. Then on July 23rd, 15-year-old Raymond King Jr., he left his house to go to the Canada Manpower Office, which is like a youth employment agency. And he was really super excited to get his first real job. So he had been going there every weekday looking for like postings and hoping that something's going to come up. He took his bike, and like he always very carefully did, he chained it up to the bike rack out front of the office, but he never returned for it. Now, the police immediately suspected foul play here because kids that run away, they usually take their bike with them as their mode of transportation. And then 2 days later, two things happened. The first thing, actually nobody knew about it until much later, and that was that a German exchange student named Sigrun Arndt was having a drink in a pub in Coquitlam with a middle-aged man that afternoon, and she was never seen alive again. And the other thing that happened that day was that the body of 14-year-old Judy Cosma turned up near Weaver Lake. Now, she had been stabbed a number of times. Now, I'm not sure if 18-year-old Randy, who I'm not going to give his last name, came forward with this information when he learned that Judy's body had been found, or if he was tracked down and questioned about Judy's murder. I'm thinking he came forward about it, but I could be wrong on that. Anyways, Randy told the police that on July 9th, him and his friend were driving around and heading towards New Westminster. And his friend saw a girl that he knew coming out of a phone booth outside of the Royal Columbian Hospital, and they waved at each other, and she came over to the car and started to talk to them. Now, Randy had never seen her before, but his friend obviously knew who she was, and she seemed happy to see him, like, so they knew each other. So I guess they had met when she was working at McDonald's, the McDonald's that he used to go to. And she was on her way to Richmond for a job interview at a Wendy's. And this friend of his said, well, hop in, we'll take you there. And so she happily got into the car with the two of them. Now, his friend liked to drink and drive. So he offered him and Judy some beer, and she took one. And by the time they got to Richmond, it was too early for her to go to her job interview. So they all got out and went into the Richmond Inn to buy some more beer. And when they got back into the car, Randy got in the back seat, and Judy sat up front with his friend. And he heard him offer Judy a job washing windows for $10 an hour cash. He also offered her this little green pill, which he said would straighten her out and keep her from getting drunk. And she took that. He then dropped Randy off at the Lougheed Mall. And so they asked him, like, well, so when did you see this friend again? He said, well, not until sometime after the 21st of July, because and at that point, he said that he dropped her off in Richmond and that him and his wife were going on vacation the next day to Knott's Berry Farm. So he wasn't back until the 21st. And what is the name of this friend of yours? Clifford Olsen. Okay, so we have to do a little bit more regrouping here. Now, at this point, we have Judy's body found. Darren John Rood's body has been found by this time, and Christine Weller's. But none of the other murders have been connected at this point. Now, they believe strongly that Simon and Ada were both murdered. But again, they're different genders and ages, so they still aren't convinced that that they're all the act of one person, but they're starting to like this Clifford Olsen guy, at least for Judy's murder. On July 27th, 1981, 15-year-old Terry Carson was supposed to be at a job interview at a pet store in Guildford, which is in Surrey. But she had last been seen at a convenience store in Mission, BC, with a man kind of in his 30s, and she never came home. So on July 30th, Constable Fred Mail comes up with this idea that Clifford Olson, he's known, everybody knows that he's greedy. So if we tell him that there's a reward offered in exchange for some information about these disappearances, he might go back to one of the crime scenes and get some kind of evidence or something, and we can put him under surveillance and see where he goes. So they arrange to send an officer to meet up with Olson for coffee and tape the conversation. So they meet at a White Spot of all places. As a kid, I loved White Spot. I used to love their kids menu because I'd go with my grandparents and they had the lunch. The kids' lunch would come in like a cardboard box that was like a cutout of a pirate ship, and they had chocolate coins. Anyways, Olson loved to brag about how this time with this Gary guy and how he got him to confess. So this officer tells him, well, we think you can help us and we're going to pay you for your services. And of course, his eyes get all lit up and he says, well, I want $3,000 a month salary and I'll get back to you if I find out anything. So perfect. Only for some reason, they don't actually start surveillance on him on that day, which I find rather unfortunate because later that same day, and I, like I said, I don't think I can overstate that enough. The same day that Clifford Olson had met with police to discuss working for them about these disappearances, 17-year-old Louise Chartrand, who was really small for her age, she was the youngest of seven children, originally from Quebec. She was living in Fraser Valley, which is just east of Vancouver. She was late for her waitress shift at Bino's restaurant. So her coworkers called her house to see what was up, and her sister immediately called the RCMP because she knew that this was not another runaway, but that she had obviously met with some kind of foul play.
As 14-year-old Judy Kozma was buried, many people in the Vancouver area were wondering if there would be more funerals like this. Kozma, Ray King, and Darren Johnstrud were murdered during a 3.5-month period. Two of the nude bodies were found near this lake. During that same time, five other youngsters have disappeared. Police and relatives have staged a massive search with no success. Posters have been printed and distributed by parents and friends. Most, like Darlene Coy, believe the missing youngsters were abducted. Her sister disappeared 7 weeks ago.
My mother is in bad shape. My father's in bad shape. I'm trying to stand up for them all. I'm doing the best I can. I haven't broke down yet. I hope everything turns out all right.
This is a composite drawing of a man police believe may be a suspect. But the head of the investigation is cautious about pinning everything on one person.
Possibly, as a gut feeling, I might feel that it is the same person or the same group of persons responsible. But like I say, in order to conduct an entire investigation, we're looking at all possibilities.
Police from many areas are continuing their door-to-door search. Parents of the missing children are demanding more help, and the search is expected to be expanded today. John North, ABC News, Vancouver, British Columbia.
So that night, Olson stopped at the Squamish RCMP detachment. He had to pick up a gun that they had confiscated from him earlier, and then he headed to Whistler. But little did anybody know that Louise was actually in the car with him when he stopped at that RCMP detachment. So when the call comes in the next day that Louise didn't make it the night before, they decide that, you know, maybe we should watch this Clifford guy for a bit and just kind of see what he does. Like maybe this Forsyth guy was right and he could be our guy. Now, Olson didn't make the tail on him very easy, though. He liked to use a lot of rental cars and he would swap them every couple of days. And he also drove like a lot, like putting on like 20,000 kilometers in 3 months using about 14 different rental cars. But they kind of did their best to keep him in their sights. Now, on August 12th, Olson took the ferry over to Vancouver and he headed towards Nanaimo. Now, he was being watched by a helicopter and he pulled over and he picked up two women hitchhiking and then headed towards this remote area of the island at Hydro Hill and then turned onto a dirt logging road. Now, the RCMP moved into action. They were pretty worried that something was going to happen to these two girls. Now, they caught up with Olson and his two passengers and they were sharing a bottle of booze. They were outside the vehicle. But when Olson spotted the cops kind of appearing out of the the darkness. He sprinted to his car and tried to escape, but they had actually already set up a roadblock, so he was cornered. So he was charged that night with impaired driving, and his car was impounded. And they found in the vehicle the address book of Judy Cosmo. Now, one of the 16-year-old girls that had been with Olson at the time said that he had offered her a job and given her one of these little green pills, which she had pocketed. So she gave it to the RCMP, and it came back as chloral hydrate, which is Mickey Finn, how it's known on the street. And basically, it's one of the earliest date rape drugs. Now, before I move on to how much more horrible this story gets, let me just tell you a little bit about this guy, Clifford Olson. So Clifford Olson was born on New Year's Day in 1940 to his mom, Leona, who worked at a fish cannery, and Clifford Sr., who worked as a milkman, which was a thing in those days. Like, someone's job was to make milk deliveries to houses. I have actually no idea when they started selling milk in stores. Someday I'll Google that. But anyways, it wasn't a wealthy upbringing, but it wasn't poor either. So Clifford Jr. was the oldest of four siblings, but something was a little bit broken with Clifford from a pretty early age. He was a show-off, a bragger, and he liked to torment the animals in the neighborhood. It's kind of a red flag. The family had moved to Edmonton when he was a baby, but they'd returned to Richmond when his father returned home from World War II. And they settled into a modest but well-kept home on Gilmore Crescent. And he started at Bridgeport Elementary School, found himself in detention a lot, just for general mischief and like smart-ass behaviors. He was regularly skipping school by the age of 10 and failed eighth grade more than once. He eventually dropped out, but not before a stint in juvenile detention. Rumors had circulated around the neighborhood that he had smothered one of the neighbor's pet rabbits. And after dropping out of school, he went to work at the Lansdowne racetrack and started to rack up a criminal history, including 83 convictions over the next 24 years. Now, mostly for things like obstructing justice, possessing stolen property, forgery, and parole violations. But there was also quite a bit of drunk driving charges and escaping custody. So in 1957, he did a stint at the New Haven Brothel Correctional Center in Burnaby. That was for a break and enter, but he escaped and stole a boat and then was caught and sent back. Now, this time he went to the Haney Correctional Center. And by the time he was 41, he had only spent a total of 4 years of his adult life outside of prison walls, and never for a stretch of more than a few months at a time. Now, he really liked to escape. And so he did that like seven times in a span of 11 years. In 1974, he was charged for repeatedly raping a 17-year-old inmate. And then in 1978, during one of the short periods that he was outside of prison, he was charged with indecent assault of a 7-year-old girl in Nova Scotia. But the West Coast, he always considered at home. So he returned to Quesnel. And then one night at the Caribou Hotel, he was out for a drink. He met a woman named Joan Hale, and he moved in with her 3 days later. Now, Joan was dragged horribly through the mud in the media when Clifford's crimes were revealed. But at that time, she was just a little bit needy and actually liked the fact that Clifford was a little bit rough around the edges because her ex-husband was bothering her. And Clifford, even though he was only about 5'7", he had this mean streak in him that people didn't mess with him. So she felt protected by him, at least at first. But he basically wound up taking her divorce settlement from her first husband, spent it all on himself, and then would often beat Joan sometimes within an inch of her life. Now, she got pregnant, and then they married a month after her and his son was born. And the night before the wedding, he had actually been accused of assaulting a 5-year-old girl that he was charged with babysitting for, but because the child was too young to testify, they didn't press any charges. And then their wedding had to be held at a different church than the Fundamental Baptist Church that they regularly attended because he had been accused of abusing several children in the congregation there. But no charges had ever been laid in any of those cases either, and he denied at the time having any kind of affinity for children. Olson wound up doing some time at an institution in Quebec. He was released in July of 1980. Now, his parole officer said of him at that time, quote, he was seen as a thief, a false pretense artist, a gralorous, extroverted, egotistical kind of person, but not as a sexual offender, end quote. But while he was in prison, Olson started to get this reputation as being a rather vicious man that liked to take his aggression out, sometimes sexually, on male inmates. And he also had no problem being a snitch. And that actually got him put into protective custody. So that was when he got moved to Prince Albert's Supermax prison and met Gary McCaw. Now, besides getting Gary to confess in rather great and graphic detail how he had lured this girl to his car with an offer of ice cream before raping and strangling her and then mutilating her body and leaving her tied to a tree. And this confession was complete with maps of these back roads between Pemberton and Whistler. And he also decided that while he was there, he was going to be an informant on two inmates who were planning on smuggling in some drugs. Now, he managed to get paid $3,500 by the Saskatchewan Criminal Compensation Board for that information, but it also got him stabbed 7 times by a prison gang. Now, unfortunately, he lived, thanks to our Canadian healthcare system. So Clifford Olson was officially charged with Judy Cosma's murder on August 18th of 1981. And 2 days later, something happened that, well, no one knew about it until about a year later. And I actually don't know how I really feel about it. I mean, I kind of get it, but I also find it really offensive at the same time.
Police expect Clifford Robert Olson to be charged next week with at least 5 of 9 known murders in the Vancouver area. 2 youngsters are still missing, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police believe they are dead. So far, Olson is charged with first-degree murder in the death of 14-year-old Judy Cosma. Yesterday, searchers found the body of 17-year-old Louise Marie Chartrand. The dead and missing youngsters range in age from 9 to 17 years. The 9 bodies were found nude and had either been bludgeoned or stabbed to death. The search is continuing this weekend in the Vancouver suburbs where the children's bodies have been found. So far, the search today has turned up nothing new. But at a news conference, police indicated they believe they have the man responsible.
We do have a suspect in relation to these murders, and charges could be laid after Mr. Hall has reviewed the material we have, and that will be up to Mr. Hall.
One suspect in all the cases?
Yes.
Hall is Crown Prosecutor John Hall, who is preparing charges against suspect Olson in what police call the worst case of mass murder in British Columbia history. John North, ABC News.
So Clifford tells the police, like, look, I know stuff about the disappearance of these kids that have been happening. And if you pay me for each kid, I'll take you to the bodies so that their parents can have a proper burial. Now, they already knew that Olson was a bragger and that he was super greedy, not to mention an escape artist. They figured he was probably lying to get an opportunity to sneak out of custody. And they still weren't convinced at this case that any of these cases were at all connected. Now, they did already have the body of Christine Weller, Darren John's Root, and Judy Cosma, but even the case against Olson for Judy's death was kind of weak. There was really nothing to tie him to anyone else's murders, and he's definitely not going to give up any kind of confession without money, but they can't pay him for it. Like, you're not allowed to profit from a crime, so he says, we'll give the money to my wife. Now, once you find them all, I'm going to go to prison for life anyway. So I just want to make sure that my wife and kid is like they have some money to live off of. So they figure, well, he's lying anyways. And what's the harm? This is all supposed to kind of be done in secret anyways. So they're like, fine. So he makes this deal. And the deal is the first body is a freebie. Then when you see that I'm not kidding or that I'm not lying, it's $100,000 for 7 more bodies. And I'll bring you to where I hid some things that will connect me to Christine, Darren, and Judy's murders. But not without getting this agreement to pay my wife the money. Then I'll take you to them one at a time in the order that I say, and you'll put the money into the account for Joan. And so he took them to the bodies of Louise Chartrand. She was found in Whistler. Colleen Dagnault, she was found in Surrey. Terry Carson in Chilliwack. Then there was 4 different locations where they found some kind of like souvenirs or personal items of Christine, Darren, and Judy's. Ada Court was found in Agus. Raymond King near Alpine Lake. Sandra Wolfsteiner in Chilliwack. Now, they didn't actually know that Sandra Wolfsteiner was even a murderer. Simon Partington in Richmond, and then this, and then Sigrun Art, the German exchange student. Now, he didn't remember her name. They never specified where she was actually found. So 8 girls, 3 boys. Now, he can say all he wants to, that he did this deal so that the parents could have closure and do proper burials. But he'd also said at one point that if he cared about the parents, he wouldn't have killed their kids. So now I'm going to circle back to Sandra Wolfsteiner and Terry Carson, because they were not even connected to Olson until he took them to their bodies. Sandra, like, she wasn't even particularly on their radar as a possible murder. She was considered to have run away. Clifford Olson had picked her up from outside her boyfriend's place in Surrey just about 4 days after his wedding to Joan. She lived in Langley, but her boyfriend was living in Surrey. This was around 11:30 on May 19th, 1981. And then she had left. She was going to go to a body shop just up the road, and she was going to hitchhike there. She got into Olson's rental car. He convinced her that they were actually going to go to his cabin because he'd offered her a job washing windows. I think it was for like $16 an hour. But he walked her into the woods just off of Chilliwack Lake Road and then bludgeoned her with a hammer from behind. He pocketed the $10 she had in her wallet before dumping her body and then driving away. Terry Carson was also on her way to a job interview at the pet store. Now, he had picked her up and offered her cash for a job as well. He fed her vodka and then slipped her a Mickey before taking her behind a bank and then assaulting her while she was passed out. He then drove her to a side road in the mountains. She was still alive, but he became angry that she hadn't moved and was still passed out. So he assaulted her again. And then it took out a Phillips screwdriver from his pocket along with his hammer and then drove the screwdriver into her forehead. Now, she was surprisingly, according to him anyways, still breathing at that point. So he assaulted her again and then drug her over to the creek, put her face down in the water, and then stepped on her shoulders to keep her head from coming out of the water. He threw a few branches on top of her and drove away. And then he stopped, threw the hammer and the screwdriver into the river, hid her jewelry in an opening of a tree. He had a change of clothes in the trunk, so he changed his clothes, cut the labels out of the clothes that he had been wearing, and then cut them up before also throwing them in the river. So that was kind of his MO, kind of how he worked. Girl or boy, old or younger, it really didn't matter to him. And so he originally entered a not guilty plea, but he changed it to guilty in January of 1982 because of this confession and deal that he'd made on January 14th, 1982. He was given 11 concurrent life sentences. And that same day is when the media discovered the deal. And let's say the public wasn't exactly happy about it. And I also find it really appalling myself, but if we look at it logically, like by turning over $100,000 to, I mean, technically his wife and his kid, it did save the government the cost, which could have been in the millions for a trial. He was never going to confess without any money, so they would have had to try him only on Judy's death. There was, of course, no guarantee that a jury would convict on what evidence they did have against him. So looking back on it with the gift of 40 years now, I'm not really as appalled as I was when I first heard about it. I mean, I think it's still sick. I mean, the idea of paying cash for bodies, but I kind of get why the deal was made. And it did guarantee a conviction and that Olson would spend the rest of his life in prison. So, and it's not like he's going to go on a spending spree for himself if he's behind walls. He goes down as a child killer in prisons. He's not going to be exactly a cakewalk for him. Like, child killers don't normally do very well in prison. So I kind of get it. But please don't worry. That was not the end of the controversy that was stirred up over Clifford Olson and his pathetic life in prison. In the fall of 1984, the Supreme Court of BC decided to take a look at this little deal that they had made. And the families of the victims were pretty pissed, to say the least, that Olson had gotten financial benefit out of their, basically, their grief and their trauma. So they were writing letters to the federal solicitor general, and Olson was also threatening to sell his memoirs. He had written a manuscript in the third person. It had lots of spelling mistakes and grammatical errors. And these families, the families of the victims, they had actually had their child benefits payments withheld from them because their children had presumed to have been run, like presumed to have run away, and then they were dead, so they didn't get any benefits anymore. So, you know, you just kind of got to let that sink in for a bit, how that must have made them feel. So 7 of the families made the decision to get a lawyer, which took the case for free, to sue Joan and Olson's defense lawyer for this money, for this $100,000. Well, of course, all the lawyers stalled for like 3 years, and it was initially ruled that the money with interest had to be returned plus the legal costs. But that was overturned on appeal in March 11th, 1996. And that was by the BC Court of Appeals. Now, the Supreme Court of Canada refused to even listen to an appeal from that court. So that's basically how it stood. And then at that time, Joan said to the media, quote, "I think that money was given to me in good faith. I don't have a guilty conscience. I can look at myself in the mirror and say, you're a good person. Don't be ashamed," end quote. Now, on May 2nd, 1986, Darren John Drood's parents got a letter from Olson. Not sure how it was actually allowed to get through the mail. The letter basically detailed rather graphically what was done to their son. On December 15th, 1989, now this is from the Kingston Penitentiary, he said that he had found God and that God had forgiven him, saying, quote, "I've asked for forgiveness, I've been forgiven, and that's the end of it," end quote. Then on March 11th, 1997, Olson, working as his own attorney, decided to invoke this faint hope clause, which is something that I've kind of talked about it before in other cases. So back in the day, the Supreme Court of Canada decided that it was really mean to give people really long parole ineligibility periods for people that were serving life sentences. So you could apply for early parole after serving only 15 years under this faint hope clause. Now, on January 9th of 1997, the wording of this law, which has since been completely abandoned, was changed, that multiple murderers were not eligible for this. But Olson had become eligible while it was still under the old wordings. So he was able to get a hearing about it, much to the family's disgust. Darren's parents, Garen and Sharon, they had actually been working for years hard as victim rights, like building this victim rights group. Gary said, quote, "It's insanity, a circus. This whole thing has brought my anger and frustration back to where it was 15 years ago," end quote. But here in Canada, we really like our prisoners' rights. So a now 57-year-old Olson showed up to his hearing in a dirty t-shirt, sat behind a bulletproof bit of glass to tell the jury that they need to let him out because there was a lot of unsolved crimes that he felt he had left to confess to, and that he had actually been involved in some of the Green River killings down in the States, was something that Seattle investigators really scoffed at. And he called a couple of his own character witnesses. There was one, Dr. Tony Marcus. He said that he was just as devious as he was when he was convicted. And then the other forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Stanley Semra, who said that he was completely untreatable and enjoys his status as a celebrity serial killer, calling him the most disturbed, most pathological personality that he had ever encountered. So it took the jury just 15 minutes to deny his application. In June of 1997, he was transferred from the Prince Albert Penitentiary to St. Anne de Plains in Quebec. And then on August 21st, 2001, he came up for parole again. Now, this time they took 17 minutes to decide that prison is where he needed to be still. Now, I should mention here that there are actually 2 other cases that Olson is suspected in, but he's never confessed or been tried for. There was 17-year-old Verna Berkey. Now, she went missing from Hope, BC. She had gone to a party, and then the next day, she wanted to go back to Kamloops, and that was on May 2nd, 1981. She planned on hitchhiking there. Verna had really liked to draw. She was really good at it. And 6 months later, her purse and roller skates were found in the river with rocks in them near Highway 7. And then there's Pamela Darlington, who's also from Kamloops. She had just turned 19 in October of 1973. Her sister, Laurel, said that her car wouldn't start, so she decided to hitchhike into town to visit some friends. And she was last seen by her cousin at the Thompson Pub with a good-looking guy with shaggy hair. Her body was found along the Thompson River on November 7th. She had been sexually assaulted and beaten to death. Then on July 18th, 2006, he applied for parole again. Now, this time the National Parole Board said, quote, Mr. Olson presents a high risk and psychopathic risk. He's a sexual sadist and a narcissist. If released, he will kill again, end quote. And then he said, well, he no longer wished to request parole and that he is going to go back to his cell and he's not going to come back and hear their decision. Quote, I won't be coming back to hear your retarded decision, end quote. In 2008, it came to Gary John Rood's attention. Now, he had been a huge victim rights advocate that Olson had some items up for sale at murderauction.com. In March of 2010, Olson, who always liked to give interviews and brag about stupid stuff, told the Toronto Sun that now that he was 70, he was getting his old age pension benefits. Well, this completely outraged the public and the families, of course, and a quick investigation into it found that it was true. He was getting $1,169.47 every month from his CPP and old age security, and that the funds were being put into a trust account for his son. Now, he also got a medical pass to a hospital, and Susan Johnsrud said of that, quote, Olson is still a very dangerous psychopath who would kill within 5 minutes if he escaped. And the last time he went to the hospital, he was found to have hidden a key in his rectum. He's probably gloating about the pension funds in his trust fund while the victims' rights groups are struggling for funds or have to shut down. Even though seven of the families have obtained judgment against Olson, we weren't even told about the pension funds the government is keeping for him in trust, end quote. Now, the federal minister was not impressed once he found out about this, and he decided to review how pension funds are paid out. Like, as it stood, anyone with no other form of income could collect their old age pension from the government. And the Human Resources Minister, Diane Finley, said, quote, Canadians are outraged that prisoners like child killer Clifford Olson are receiving taxpayer-funded benefits. Prisoners also have their basic needs met in prison by taxpayers. We will not forget the crimes committed by Clifford Olson, and his desire to maintain his taxpayer-funded entitlements is deeply insulting to his victims and their families. This bill is the fair and right thing to do, end quote. But of course, Olson tried to fight it in writing a letter to Ottawa saying, quote, it should be brought to your attention that I still pay taxes, which is in all caps and spelt wrong, and file the federal taxes, again, all caps and again, spelt wrong. I look forward to a court case I will bring if the bill you want to remove my old age pension you have paid into, end quote. But remove his benefits they did, saving us taxpayers about $2 million a year, because at the time it was discovered that there were actually 400 inmates getting their pensions. In September of 2011, the families of the victims got word that Clifford Olson, now at 71, had terminal cancer. He died on September 30th, 2011, and Raymond King's dad said, quote, I don't have to think about it anymore, about him anyways. He's never going to pop up in our lives again. He's never going to open those wounds again. It's done. It's over. Now it's time for me, end quote. And Trudy Court, who's Ada's sister, said, quote, these are tears of happiness because justice is done for the children. Our justice system couldn't do it for him, but life has. He's gone now, end quote. Serge Abergale, who's the Quebec region spokesman for the Correctional Services of Canada, made sure to let the public know that there would be a funeral, but out of respect for him, one of the biggest asshats in history that his own family had given up on years ago, quote, there will come a point where the funeral will happen, and it's likely that it will be at an undisclosed location, so the public will not be made aware of the whereabouts, end quote. Now, before I go, I found this rather obscure interview that was done by the woman's name is Jessica. I'm not actually sure the man's name, but it was found on a channel called Prison. And I can't really give you a date on when this interview was done, but it was released after his death. And I'm going to play a little bit of it for you here. If I can, I'm going to link it in the show notes if you want to check it out for yourself and listen to the whole thing.
Go ahead and ask them about the two construction companies I have. We don't want to tell you that. I got more money on construction companies, $100,000. $6,000 for what they give me wasn't even the toilet paper I'd lick my
hand. I didn't say it was. I just said you got that for saying that you were guilty.
The problem was this. They had nothing on me, okay? Now, what happened? About 135 or 36 RCMP across Canada, and they had me under surveillance 24 hours around the clock for 3 weeks, okay? Now, they picked me up 3 times for picking up some girls, and I let them go on that, you know what I mean? And they had me in custody overnight and cut me loose, et cetera, et cetera. And they had helicopters up in the fucking in the air, which you could pick me up at with a night spotter, you know, the infrared stuff, etc. And every place I could go, I could never shake them. I could never pick them up. You get what I'm getting at? No matter what, there was always 20 cars ahead of me. They had all the towns back, grad things, every house, everything. You couldn't lose them. You get what I'm getting at? So when I went to camp, they gave me the videotapes, you get what I'm getting at? And me blowing the safe and two little arm robbies, you get what I'm getting? The deposit, $32,000 on each of them. And they never got that back. So I told them, I said, listen, I bought Joan a car. See, she had a divorce, she got $64,000. And anyway, that was nothing because she had $500,000 in her bank account right off the bat from our thing that I give her. Anyway, to make sure on our marriage, to make sure, story short, I said to the RCMP, I said, listen, he says, they're going to withdraw the charges. You talk to Bob. He represented me. I said, to make a short story short, I said to Bob, the world press there, they have never had anything in Canada like that. So to make a short story short was that I just tell them we're pleading guilty and we'll give them all the bodies. And that was it.
Wow.
Paid $100,000. The parents that went after it, tried to get it. They couldn't get it. Like I told you, you got all that stuff. You get what I'm getting at? You see it when you get it there. And that's the end of it.
And that was the horrific crimes of Clifford Olson. And I'm going to be back again next week with another case. In the meantime, you know what to do with your rates, reviews, subscribe to the exclusive content, whatever you do, and share with your friends. And as always, thank you so much for listening.